This is Kate Moorhead Carroll in the podcast Find It. Today I am so blessed to have two incredible musicians with me, really stars of Jacksonville, even the nation. Our own Tim Tuller, our organist choir master, and Courtney Lewis, who is the conductor of the Jacksonville Symphony Orchestra. Welcome to both of you. Thanks for being with me.
Thank you. Thanks.
I thought we'd begin this morning just by finding out a little bit more about church and music for both of you, because both of you, I think, have associated church with music. So starting with you, Courtney, how did worship and music kind of come together for you as a child?
Well, the first place that I ever encountered any kind of serious music was church, and it's among my earliest memories. I grew up in a Presbyterian church that had a pretty Anglican slant in terms of its music. There was piano and guitar and sort of a section of worship songs, but the main hymns were the hymns that we would know from the American hymnal. And some of my most potent early memories are of music in that church. I think I mentioned it before in the Dean's Forum. I remember the chords under the doxology, under the old 100th, just being fascinated by how they moved. And I also had, you know, I was very kind of evangelical in my fervor for Christianity for most of my childhood. It would be very embarrassing to look back at it now. But I think that all that kind of fervor was actually the same feeling as loving music. There wasn't any differentiation between feeling God's presence or what God in me meant and what music was. They were one and the same thing. And then for a while I thought that was a problem, but now I think actually it's exactly right. It's one of the semantic-less ways. The abstraction of music allows us to feel God's presence in a non-verbal way quite often.
Yes.
And other art forms can't do that because they can't be unsemantic in quite the same way.
When you say unsemantic, you mean not verbal?
Correct.
Okay.
They can't have a story. I mean, a hymn tune has hymn words, but the actual notes don't tell a story.
Yes. And they evoke a feeling more than tell a story.
Exactly.
Yeah.
And that, not vagueness, but limitless possibility in that is I would imagine, the kind of atmosphere in which many people would find themselves able to feel closer to God than in a more specific place.
Opening the heart to a sense of wonder, or at least a sense of experience.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
That's beautiful. And Tim, I remember hearing that you were given a piano earlier. You didn't really talk a lot, but wanted to play the piano very early, right?
Well, actually, my very first instrument, interestingly enough, that I actually had access to in terms of keyboard instrument was a little reed organ. These little keyboards, they're kind of like a cross almost between an organ and an accordion in some sense. They're a little, you don't really see them anymore.
Harmonium kind of?
Kind of. Mm-hmm. It has a keyboard, but you can play regular notes on it's a short keyboard. But there are little tabs you'd press to play, fill in the chords.
Oh, interesting.
And it had kind of a whiny sort of a sound. It had a little fan in it. And they were more common like in the 60s and 70s in households. But that was my very first instrument. I used to play around that.
How old were you when you played?
Oh, gosh, four, five, six. Okay. But that wasn't my first musical experience. My first real musical experience actually was younger than I could almost talk. It was when I was very, very young. Like three, maybe two or three, was our house where I grew up was located right across the street from a church. It happened to be a Presbyterian church as well.
Yeah, the Presbyterians and, done a lot to bring musicians into the church.
And I remember they had a little bell tower that played chimes. Every once in a while, it would play like hymns and things on the chimes. And these weren't real chimes. They were electronic, I think. But nonetheless, they would play these traditional hymns on the chimes. And I was just transfixed by that as a child. Well, finally, it was about May or June of 1983, my mother decided that she should go to church, because my parents were not religious. They didn't go to church at all. My dad never did. But my mom decided that, good, upstanding, middle-class citizen should go to church. She didn't really care.
This was an upstate New York.
She really didn't care what church. Oh, there's a church across the street. Well, let's just go there. And it happened to be a Presbyterian church. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't anything that you consider by modern standards to be a great music program, but it was a very traditional mm-hmm. music program. They had a choir and they had an organ and they sang the traditional hymns. So we started going there, and immediately I was just transfixed by the hymns, the organ especially. Immediately. And it's all I could think about. And I would talk about it all the time to my folks, and I would demand that they, like, get me information about what an organ was. And I had them look me up. We had this old 1960s encyclopedia set, and I'd have them look me up pictures of organs in the encyclopedia.
And how old were you at this point?
About seven.
Wow.
About seven.
And they were not musical at all.
No,
right?
Not in the slightest. There's no music in my family whatsoever.
Wow.
None. They didn't even play the radio.
But
no.
Courtney, you have music in your family, yes?
Yeah, I mean, I'm the first professional musician, but both my mother and father had piano lessons. My father was obsessed with music, and I think would have been a much happier person in life if he'd been a musician. And then my brother and sister and I all had piano lessons, plus sang in choirs, plus played an orchestral instrument.
Oh, so, like me, my mother was a concert pianist, but you, Tim, mm-hmm. you were fighting for it.
Yeah.
You had to fight for it.
Yeah, and finally, when I was about, not too long after that, sometimes about, I think I was not quite eight yet, or maybe I was eight, I finally convinced them to get me organ lessons. And oddly enough, I started with an organ in a sense, in that it was one of these old, it was a step up from the reed organ I just mentioned, but it was a sort of a living room, Hammond-style organ. It wasn't a Hammond, but it was that style. It had a short pedal board, and you see these in the houses in the 1970s quite a bit.
Yeah.
And they got a teacher that would come to the house and started teaching me the basics of music on this thing.
So that was before you played the piano?
Absolutely. My fingers did not touch piano keys until I was probably 12 or 13 years old.
But that was a shock.
Yeah. And so I kept on this, and I got more and more serious, and finally that teacher finally retired or whatever it was, I can't remember, but she quit teaching. And I wanted to keep going on this, so my parents found a different organ teacher at a local music school that was willing to take me to the church organ that I had heard growing up and see if I could actually start getting serious about it on an actual church organ. Mm. Now, that was when I was 14. We got permission from the church, and I started taking lessons on the church organ that I'd heard growing up, mm-hmm. which was amazing.
You must have been really excited.
Right, yes. But then he told me something very important, and one of the biggest things that, biggest advice I would give to young musicians growing up, said, like, look, you're 14, you've been doing this organ thing for about 7 years now. You need some piano background, because a properly trained organist has to have piano background, and I personally don't think I've ever spoken to another organist who literally started on the organ. Yeah. Everybody should start on piano for at least 3 years.
It's so fundamentally different. I can't play the organ at all because my fingering isn't good enough.
That's just a sidebar. I mean, people think, oh, there's two keyboards, they're the same. They're about as different as two instruments could ever be, ever.
Really?
Absolutely.
I mean, if you want to lift your hand off and move it up on a piano, you stick your pedal down and it all stays and you can jump up.
Right.
But if you stop on an organ, it just stops.
Right.
And it's very clear to everybody in the congregation that you've messed it up.
Right. Oh, yes. And of course, organ, it makes no difference how hard you touch the keys, whereas piano, that's everything.
Yeah.
Let's pause for a minute, because many churches now do not have organs. Many of these new churches are totally rock and roll.
Yeah.
Tell us about what the organ does for music. Tell us about what it does when people are singing,
mm-hmm.
Because I think that's getting lost a bit. Let's mm-hmm. recover that a bit.
Right. There's a big history to that, and I think a lot of people might, if they think about it for a second, wonder, well, why the organ? Why has that been the traditional church music, instrument for, centuries? And, there's a couple of real basic reasons for that. First off, organs can fill a large space, and they were an instrument that was able to fill a large space with sound long before the advent of electricity. Understand, organs are one of the oldest instruments in existence. Mm-hmm. They're older than, much older than pianos, older than harpsichords, older than any other keyboard instrument.
And why were they, why did people create them for that purpose, to fill a large space,
to
support singing?
At least in the West, from at least the 10th century, that's true, but there is history of organs going back to the ancient Greeks. Mm. Instruments that were powered by there was this thing called the hydraulis, and they were powered by a sort of a pneumatic system of wind pressure and things like that. But at least as far back as the 10th century, there's stories of them being in churches. There's a famous organ from the 10th century called the Winchester organ that was the largest organ of its time, and they said it could be heard all throughout the city when it was played.
So was that the original intent, just to project sound as far as possible? Was that the idea, or was it more about support, or both?
Well, I'm not really too up on the hit, and perhaps Courtney knows a little bit about the real ancient history of, say, things like the hydraulis in ancient Greece. I think that was often used like outdoor events and things like that.
I think the thing is it's the most sound one person can make on one instrument.
Right.
So you only employ one musician.
Yeah.
And also, the thing that everybody always forgets about a piano is that the second you play a note on a piano, it decays.
Precisely.
Like, incredibly quickly.
Yeah. Oh, right.
So it's a percussion instrument, you ping, 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 but the sound, we think of it sustaining, but it doesn't actually. It decays very, very quickly.
Right. Mm-hmm.
An organ really sustains.
And that sustain helps to support a congregation singing.
Correct.
So you've got the two big factors, I would say, for having them traditionally in church is, number one, they can produce a lot of sound and fill the space, and also fill it with what I like to least think is an awe-inspiring sound. But also, the sustain underpins the congregation singing in a way that no other instrument can, or at least couldn't before the advent of electricity.
Okay, so now that we've gotten to electricity, we have these booming guitars, why is the organ better? Why is the organ, for me, the organ lifts my soul in a way that the guitar and the drums just don't do. Now, is that just a question of style, or is there actually something more precise about its sound?
Well, there is something slightly impersonal about it, isn't there? And I don't mean that in a kind of pejorative way, but there's something that is, it's not as susceptible to hyper nuance of expression as much as a violin or a piano, where every note can be a different volume and you can phrase with volume. An organ is sort of above that, and I think that somehow reflects godlike character.
There's an interesting point that I heard a bishop, I can't remember which bishop it was, but it was one a musical convention I was at, and he talked about the difference between the immanence of God and the eminence of God.
What is the difference?
Immanence of God is the immediacy, the intimacy.
Yeah.
The eminence of God is the grandeur.
The transcendence.
Yeah, the transcendence, the grandeur. And I think the organ does a really good job at the eminence of God. Now, I think it can do the eminence as well. That's sort of different. But I think large scale, when you hear it loud and with hymns and full size, then you're really hearing the eminence side of that.
I have to say that you know how much I admire your playing, but one of my favorite things in the service is when there is needed to be extra time between the penultimate and the final verses of the hymn on procession. And you always come up with something that is unbelievably inspiring and original, and yet everybody knows exactly when to come back in, and it finds its way right back. And the tempo never changes, and there are no wrong notes, and you play at a tempo that everybody can sing with. And I don't mean to make comparisons, but I was at the National Cathedral a few weeks ago, and that organist did not carry the congregation along at the right tempo. It's a really special skill, because you've got to be ahead, but not too ahead.
Well, I appreciate you saying that, because when I look out there and the procession isn't done, and there's more time, I'm like, oh shoot!
And actually, that's when some of the creativity comes out. And
you have to wonderful.
No,
and also the fact that you're responsible for the whole thing yourself. I mean, you know, in some ways I am, but I am through other people. If I stopped, it would keep going. But you have to be the whole thing.
Yeah.
I mean, it's pretty awesome.
But one more point about the sound of an organ. There's a purity to it that it's different from if we could fill the cathedral with an amplifier and a guitar. But there is something different about the sound. It's a natural sound.
Right, yes.
There is something, to me, more sacred about that.
There's a purity to it,
purity.
I think.
Maybe that's
and what people think of it, I think most people think of an organ, modern organ, they don't think of it as an acoustic instrument. But it actually, in fact, is an acoustic instrument. Even though nowadays they're...
Explain what acoustic means
okay.
to people.
So acoustic instrument is an instrument whose sound is produced by mechanical means, not electric.
Oh, okay.
But so any traditional orchestral instrument is acoustic, you know, a violin, a flute, a tuba, anything. They're all acoustic instruments. But they produce their sound through a mechanical, physical means, not through electricity. Mm. And an organ, even though it's powered nowadays by electricity, the actual sound is produced by acoustic means. So the pipes that the air gets blown up into are acoustic in the same exact way that a flute or a clarinet is.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, it's so amazing to think that in Bach's time, every time he practiced, there was some poor soul at the back of the organ, you know, literally pushing the bellows with all his might, hour after hour, so the Kapellmeister could rehearse.
That's amazing.
Yeah.
So the worship, in its essence, is all about trying to provide a container within which a human being can encounter the presence of God. And we do this through all of the senses, really. There's touch, there's taste, there's sight. We have different colors for different seasons. There's beauty, stained glass. But of course, in the end, one of the greatest vehicles for lifting the soul is this idea of music. But what I think a lot of people don't understand is that the music also is expressive of the season in which we are worshiping. So tell, if you both could tell us a little bit about how does music evoke mood? How does it do that?
Can I start that one?
Please.
Well, one of the things that's so great about traditional worship, if we want to call it that style, is that it's something that's come about through centuries and through many different nationalities. Mm-hmm. So it may have style that's peculiar to one place at one moment, but overall, the whole corpus of work that we sing and play in church is pretty multinational and very, very multi-century. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, Advent for me is E minor, O Come Emmanuel, and funny modal sevenths. You know, the plain chant, the music began in the church, of course. Western music began with Gregorian chant, with the stuff that you still sing so well.
When was that about?
So Leonhard and Paratam were the first people to work on that, but it would have been like sort of 4th century, 5th century?
Oh, yeah. It goes deep into Western history.
And then in pre-Renaissance, so like the 12th and 13th century, two composers in Notre Dame began to fiddle around with just putting another voice in parallel with a fifth or a fourth, which sounds really weird to us today because it's illegal, according to Western law. We're all taught not to do it at university. But that began to be the beginning of counterpoint and of different voices doing different things. So I think a lot of the universality and the kind of lack of, I mean, if you hear a Graham Kendrick chorus from 1990, it sounds like an Englishman writing in 1990, in a way that dates really quickly, in a way that a 13th century plain chant does not. But there are also sort of all sorts of funny harmonic characteristics of the plain chants that are different from other kinds of Western music that for me immediately makes it feel like it's in church. You know, like funny degrees of the scale.
But there is a kind of transcending time about it, really.
Yes.
It remains relevant even centuries and centuries later. It still moves people.
Yeah.
That is something.
Yeah. And also that sound of, you know, that Advent sound, it's so French, O Come Emmanuel, that you just feel like you're about to see Quasimodo pop out of the rafters.
Well, because Advent is all about waiting.
Yeah.
It's all about the time between the worlds where Christ has not yet come. We're waiting for Christ to be born and remembering the birth, but we're actually remembering that Christ is going to come again, and we're supposed to be looking for him and waiting all the time. So that's that sound. It's a sort of a not yet ripened sound.
Right. It's not quite joyful.
Yeah.
It's expectant.
It's expectant.
Yeah.
That's a good word.
And then Christmas for me, the sound of Christmas is a 9/8 suspension.
A which?
A 9/8
suspension.
Oh! All right, well, you guys, I don't know what that means. Yeah. What does that expand upon?
It's
that?
A particularly joyful dissonance that sounds like bells, and Christmas carols are full of it.
What does Advent mean to you, Tim? What are the sounds that it evokes?
Well, yes, very, very similar to what Courtney was saying. I think, and this point cannot be stressed enough, if it hadn't been for the church, particularly the medieval Catholic Church, there would be no Bach, there would be no Beethoven, there would be no Mozart, there would be no Western music as we know it today, mm-hmm. not even close. Mm-hmm. It was all incubated in that mm-hmm. medieval Catholic tradition. Everything that we think of as Western music, all of it.
Mozart had a church job until he was 29.
Oh, yeah.
And then ran away from Salzburg because the Archbishop was so sick of him writing concertos instead of masses.
He was a wild one.
But I mean, all the way into the middle of the 18th century, the church was still the foundation of
absolutely
music patronage. Mm.
Yeah, and what we have to remember, we're cultural creatures, and we are the inheritors of centuries and centuries of some of the finest musical minds in the world that have ever lived over the centuries, creating music especially for the church and the seasons of the church. And so, you know, nowadays, you know, we're the inheritors of hundreds of years of composers, and many of them very pious, very religious, authentic, expressing their feelings about Advent with their Advent music, or mm-hmm. expressing their feelings about Lent with their Lenten music, and so on and so forth. And we're the inheritors of all that. And that has really shaped, I think, our sense of what Advent sounds like, or what Lent sounds like. Like you were saying with O Come Emmanuel and things like that. Yeah, we're very much formed by that history that we were so lucky to inherit.
Well, and, you know, just for a side note, what is happening now? Because we have, it is the end of Christendom as we know it, and the church is recalibrating and I would say it's condensing, but the people who come seem more faithful than mm-hmm. they were when I was a child. They take it seriously, which is a good thing. But what's happening with music? Now that it is, a lot of music is no longer sacred. Where does that take us?
Well, and I think this is a huge problem in Western culture, because people not going to church means that they aren't in touch with the root of our culture. It may not be the most prominent aspect of our culture now, but Western culture grew in the church. And I think about, you know, kids I know, friends of my niece and nephew, who aren't growing up reading the Book of Common Prayer and aren't growing up singing all the hymns. I mean, we have this encyclopedia of great poetry in our heads.
Mm-hmm. Oh, yeah.
You know, from hymns.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a, I mean, there's so much high quality literature. Mm-hmm. I mean, you know, the Book of Common Prayer is almost part of the English language. And if you don't know it, it's like not knowing Shakespeare plays. You don't know where half the expressions we use come from.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I think that it's a real problem. And I often think it's also a problem in America more than in Europe, because even when people step away from the church in Europe, it's still kind of,
it's
still there somehow.
Yeah.
But when you do it here, it kind of throws the baby out with the bathwater, and then people don't know who they are anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And I think that's a really big problem in the kind of culture wars that we see in America at the moment.
It's interesting, when I'm baptizing a child, I'll often ask the parents, what do you want this child to grow up to be like? Just getting them conscious of the fact that they're guiding this soul.
Mm-hmm.
And they'll often say things like a moral person, or a person of character, or and I will try to say to them, you know, I know that the world is going to get busy, and that soccer will become important, and whatever you're involved in. But if you bring your child to church, not only will the brain develop through all of this amazing music and the sights and sounds, but their morality will be shaped in a way that is important.
And also then they have the opportunity to choose not to be a part of it if they don't want to.
Sure.
But the other way around doesn't work, because you don't know anything.
Right, exactly. You can't choose to leave if you've never been.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
And also the community aspect is huge, too.
That's true,
being part of a community is very important. Yeah.
That's right. Yeah. So Advent for you is...
Oh, well,
so Advent. Some of your favorite. Advent
is probably my single favorite season of the church year, frankly.
And it's only 4 weeks, so we got to cram in all those hymns.
You know, I mean, I think different denominations, in some sense, I always like to half jokingly say, sort of do different seasons better. Like, I'll give Lent to the Catholics all day long. Then nobody does Lenten better than the Catholics. But I always have thought that the music and the liturgy of Advent is one of the Anglican Church's great gifts to Christendom.
Mm-hmm.
We really observe Advent, and you know, it's Advent. It's not Christmas.
It's not Christmas, and we are at that moment in time. We are different from all the
rest. Absolutely,
we really do Advent. Most
right,
of our culture has forgotten about it.
Yeah. Right, exactly.
Just because of the emphasis on the incarnation and Anglican theology?
It's the emphasis on selling stuff, I think is what it is. Okay.
Oh, no, capitalism. It's the end of the fact that we don't do Advent is because of capitalism, absolutely. Right. We want to get started with the buying.
Yeah, right.
The reason, I think, in theology that the Anglicans do Advent so well is we really embrace mystery and questioning. And Advent is all about sort of emptiness, and we do emptiness well.
Exactly.
So what about, and so Christmas the same, the bells, the...
Yeah.
Okay.
And I also like the idea that we also keep the idea that Christmas also is a season, albeit very short, 12 days. Yes, exactly.
Okay. In fact, there is no major holiday that is a day. I don't know why we've gotten it into our heads that any of these things is a day. They didn't do that. Yeah. I love that. Because we should feast for a time, not just... Yeah. Everything is so instant in our culture.
Yeah. And for me also, I this has always been a thing. It's less pronounced in Florida, but I always, early on in my life, I developed a sense of the liturgical seasons coinciding with the natural seasons of the church year. Mm-hmm. So Advent at a time when it's getting colder out and darker out and so on and so forth. And oftentimes Easter, for example, would arrive right when spring is first starting to bloom, you know, in early April and things like that. So I've often, this is a personal thing with me, I've often sort of drawn a association between the liturgical seasons and the actual natural seasons of the year.
That's beautiful. I love that. What about Epiphany? Do you have any thoughts on Epiphany? That's
I do, as of last Epiphany, not the one that just happened, but the one before, because I have one of the most incredible spiritual experiences in my life two epiphanies ago. I had an epiphany on Epiphany.
Oh, that's wonderful.
And it was whatever tune that is. It's in 6-4 and it's in G major.
Oh, Mom, Puer Nobis, is that right?
No, it's like, it sounds a bit like Puer Nobis, but slightly different. Anyway, and you were playing it after Holy Communion, and I just felt God's presence in a way I never have in my life, sort of sitting right here. And the words were particularly funny for a musician. It was, I am the Alpha and the Omega, I am the tonic and the dominant. The beginning and the end.
Yeah.
So that has become a new association for me in Epiphany. Christmas, of course, is Messiah.
Yes.
And that's a very special thing to go through, because Messiah is an Easter piece, randomly put into Christmas because of lots of different reasons. But it's really wonderful at Christmas to end with an Easter message, even though you're not there yet.
Yes.
You know, I love that about Messiah.
How many years have you done Messiah? Your whole adult life, every year?
I mean, I sang it when I was a treble, six times. I sang it on tenor the same number of times. Yeah. I've conducted it, 20 times.
And it's one of the most well-attended seasons for the orchestra.
Yeah, we make between Holiday Pops, Messiah, and the Nutcracker, we make over a quarter of our entire year ticket sales in the space of 10 days. Wow. So there's a good reason why everybody is absolutely frazzled by the time we get to Christmas.
Yes.
Yeah.
That is too bad that we exhaust ourselves, but yeah. And so Epiphany is, literally the word Epiphany means showings, and you had a showing, the veil pulled back a bit.
Mm-hmm.
What about you in Epiphany?
I love the association of Epiphany with light.
Yeah.
Yeah, exactly. I was actually at, this isn't anything musical, but I was at Joshua Tree State Park in Southern California a couple years ago on the actual day of Epiphany, January 6th. Actually, it's the desert, but it was freezing cold out, and there was a sunrise coming up and amongst all those Joshua trees in the absolute desert. It was the most amazing scene I've ever seen in my entire life.
What a beautiful picture of Epiphany.
Perfectly clear, chilly sky, and a beautiful sunrise coming up,
And what are the sounds of Epiphany, would you say, in the church? How would you describe them?
Well,
do you think it's an individual season musically too, or is it?
Yeah, it probably has. It probably, in a lot of ways, it carries on the sort of the Christmas feel in a lot of ways.
But there are hymns that we wouldn't like.
Oh, sure.
Starts with Gladness, Manifold, Epiphany.
There are some great Epiphany hymns. Yeah. Absolutely. How Brightly Shines the Morning Star is probably my favorite.
Yeah.
That one's an old German chorale, and a lot of the great composers have set musical settings of it. It's very similar to Sleeper's Wake, which is an Advent chorale that's very similar to that, but very musically rich. Mm-hmm. And a lot of composers over the centuries have set various settings of that to music.
Beautiful.
Yeah.
And then we land right, and Epiphany being one of those flexible seasons
Ooh.
that Because Easter is a part of the lunar calendar, and people usually don't know this, and you have to even go to the back of the prayer book to calculate the Easter day, but I think it's the first full moon after the spring equinox.
I've never managed to do that correctly.
Yeah. I can never get that right.
But so you back up from Easter and you get to Lent and Ash Wednesday, but tell us about the sounds of Lent. Courtney, what do you think?
That's a harder one for me, because we don't, in my symphony world, we don't really pay attention to that. So I'm going to give you that one.
Okay. Well, yeah, for me, Lent is, to me, almost as musically rich from my end as Advent. It's one of my two favorite seasons, probably musically. And in our choral tradition, well, here at St. John's and in general, throughout most of the other Anglican Episcopal churches I'm familiar with, there tends to be an emphasis on earlier music during the season of Lent.
It's
cultural. It's purely cultural, admittedly. But there's a certain, at least compared to a lot of modern music, spare quality to some of these early, spare.
Yeah.
And the music of William Byrd and Thomas Tallis and John Blow and Maurice Greene, composers like that from the 17th, early 18th centuries, and even earlier, maybe, like Palestrina. A lot of their music has sort of a, what I think a lot of people now feel like is a sort of a penitential, quality to it, just inherently. Mm-hmm. Even if some of the pieces weren't necessarily specifically Lenten, it just has that sort of feel to it. Like, you listen to the William Byrd Masses, my favorite a cappella choral music probably ever.
Yeah, I love them too.
And they are at home in Lent, really at home in Lent.
And in Lent, Jesus is in the desert for 40 days fasting. I think what many people misunderstand is that they think that Lent is about kind of beating yourself up or feeling bad, but it's really not. It's just this peaceful time of reflection and discipline.
Right.
And actually, it can be a wonderful way to reorient your life. Let's say you're overeating. It can be the time that you say, I'm going to be disciplined about food or whatever.
Yep.
It's a great time to sort of redirect. And the 6 weeks or so is the perfect length to try something and get it into a habit, but it's not so intimidating.
Mm-hmm.
So you can try it, and you're not committing yourself for life.
Mm-hmm. And to take on that, I've actually heard say I can't cite it, I don't know the formalities of it, but I've actually heard research done that if you want to form a new habit, it takes about 6 weeks to do it. So it's just perfect about perfect for the Lenten for the Lenten discipline to form a new good habit.
And in terms of one of the things at the cathedral that I love is we're trying to be a little bit more green spirited. So we do a little bit of a plastic fast, just get in the habit of not getting plastic bags at the grocery store or whatever, and you try it for Lent, and then people just keep doing it.
Yeah.
And so it's a good thing. But beautiful aching penitential.
So you'll see, if you come to a Lenten Evensong or services during the season of Lent, you'll tend to hear more of early music. And the great thing about being in the Episcopal Church is, again, is that centuries-old inheritance of music I was talking about. There's a lot of it. There's a lot of great English composers from that era, tons of great sacred music from that era that is especially suitable for the season of Lent.
Yeah.
So we have so much to choose from.
Yeah, yeah. It's tough to figure out what to do.
Yeah.
And then Easter, of course, is Bach. Bach, 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 with the Easter Oratorio and the Matthew Passion. And Bach is so good at the Passion. He's so good at the drama of the Passion. We forget Bach lived as a church musician. And he wrote a cantata for every Sunday of the church year.
Amazing.
For 3.5 complete seasons, am I correct?
Yeah, I think something like that.
So, and he wrote all this, he wrote the Matthew Passion for Easter Sunday. And even then they thought it was long. I mean, can you imagine sitting there for 3.5 hours with the service in the middle of it as well? It was a long day. But I think because he was such a religious person and he followed the church year so well, there's this particular sound of the way Bach writes music can sound like many people celebrating at once, like many voices. And that's a very exciting feeling after the somber tone of Lent. the explosion of trumpets and drums in D major at Easter. I mean, it's just sort of so exciting.
So he's able to bring different instruments together in a special way?
Yeah, so Bach would only use trumpets and drums on special feast days, okay, so that the cantata for those days would sound more festive and joyful.
Yes.
Yeah, and he would choose certain keys for big feast days. Different keys at different associations. Mm. Much like what Tim was saying about the kind of need for a period like Lent to be less exuberant. Mm-hmm. Easter is exuberant.
And yeah. Easter being the resurrection celebration and lasting 50 days, so 10 days more than Lent, there is this balance in life in general between pain and pleasure and light and darkness, and you almost couldn't have the joy of Easter without Lent before it. And so it comes upon you kind of like this explosion of color and sound. And, mm-hmm. What is it like for you in Easter?
Oh, yeah, Easter is just, you know, that's when you bring the back trumpets on the organ that are silent all through Lent. You bring those back into play, and you bring the alleluias back. And, you know, there's just so much wonderful music, many wonderful hymns. Probably for me, the most center mass of all the seasons is the hymns that are associated, the congregational hymns. Mm-hmm. You know, hymns like Welcome, Happy Morning, Jesus Christ is Risen Today, Come Ye Faithful, Raise the Strain.
Yeah.
You know, to me, they're just inseparable from Easter,
yeah.
Absolutely
yeah,
inseparable.
To me, the smell of the Easter lily.
Oh, absolutely.
And all those Easter hymns.
Yeah.
It's very, very beautiful.
Yeah.
Beautiful. And the message that life can be really, really hard, but in the end, the light is more powerful than the darkness.
And again, remembering it's a season. That's another thing that gets lost to a lot of people. Easter Sunday, Easter's over. No. It's, like you say, it's 50 days.
Yeah, I wrote a whole book about that. It's called Resurrecting Easter, Meditation for Every Day of Easter. So that's good. And then we go into Pentecost. Pentecost is a Sunday, but then it moves into a whole season. But let's just talk about the Sunday for a second. Tim, what is it like for you? We've started having a fire breather on Pentecost because you know, remember the story of the disciples are in the upper room and they're when the Holy Spirit descends upon them, there's flames above their heads. So we actually have a fire breather.
Oh, yes, I remember that. I've seen that a few times.
A little bit of circus.
And then the whole church smells of petrol instead of incense.
Yeah. Well, there are parallels to Easter with the the celebration quality of it. But yeah, tongues of fire. I, of course, now, since I've been at St. John's, I really associate the hymn A Haily Festival Day. That's sort of we sort of do that as a Pentecost hymn here traditionally at St. John. A lot of places do that as an Easter hymn with different words. Okay. But we usually do it with Pentecost words. And, you know, we always make a point of having brass and a big splashy, everything big and splashy, and, you know, for that Sunday, it's a big day.
One of the things I love about Pentecost is that it's really an equal in importance to Christmas and Easter, but our culture hasn't been able to tame it.
Yeah.
So we can't make a Christmas tree or an Easter bunny out of Pentecost. It won't be contained in a Hallmark card.
Yeah, right.
So the culture's kind of abandoned it, which lets us celebrate it alone, which I like. And then we go into ordinary time.
Green season, sometimes called.
Green season, which lasts a long time.
Yeah. I actually like, there's a stretch in the middle of green season, usually around about the dead of summer, around about July and August, when a lot of the readings in church center around the Holy Eucharist and themes about the Holy Eucharist. There's lots of readings that tend to focus on bread and the feeding of people and the Eucharist. That's a big theme that's in the middle of that season oftentimes. But it is a long season.
I have one more question for you guys that is really important to me, and I think it's related to music, but I've always believed that a good liturgy has silence in it. In fact, it was funny, a number of years ago now, a parishioner came to me and said that there was a couple back behind them at a funeral, and they said, "I like that lady, Kate, but she seems to lose her place a lot." I thought that I was lost instead of pausing. So let's talk about the importance of silence in music. And it's almost like when you put paintings on a wall in an art exhibit, if you don't space them apart, if you put them all together, you wouldn't be able to see them. Mm-hmm. So Tell me about how silence, in a way, is music, or what the relationship is. Do you want to start with that?
Yeah, well, at the moment, I'm 3 weeks off doing Bruckner's Eighth Symphony, who was a very devout Catholic and, of course, the preeminent organist of his time. And he writes for the orchestra like an organist would think of in terms of registration and blocks of sound. So the winds will all play something and then the brass will play something. And he often, particularly in his finales, the music stops a lot. And that's one of the things that's hard about conducting it, to try and make it make sense, even though it keeps stopping. But he very much uses silence in those movements to make what's going to happen next more important.
And how do you conduct silence?
You have to be patient and not rush through it. You have to actually sit there and have a metronome going in your head, because if your heart rate is going and the adrenaline's pumping, you can sometimes rush through stuff like that. But
and do you not move when you're holding the orchestra in silence?
No, but you don't. You quite deliberately don't move,
okay,
because you're holding the audience as well.
Ah.
Yeah, so you might actually look a little frozen.
We are very uncomfortable with silence these days.
Yeah, yeah. Of course, you know, lots of composers were writing for acoustic spaces, mm-hmm, that are more like churches than modern concert halls.
Right.
And they would have been used to having an orchestra play in a much more resonant hall, mm-hmm, than Jacobi Symphony Hall is here, which is, you know, a beautiful sound, but it's still quite dry compared to a stone-walled cathedral.
Awesome.
Where it takes time for the sound to clear in order that the next thing can be not muffled with what happened before.
Mm-hmm.
We forget how slow sound is. Sound is so slow.
Mm.
You think of it as being an instant, but you know this, you know, the delay between what an organist sees and what actually is heard is huge, because sound is so much slower than light. And so sometimes church music needs a bit more space just to not muddle the paint colors into a brown effluvium.
But do you consider, Courtney, in your life, that it's important for you to sit in silence regularly,
yep,
so that you can hear music?
Well, I don't know about you, Tim, but I never, ever don't hear music. I'm one of those people that's going all the time.
In your head.
Yep. It never, ever stops. And every time somebody confronts me, if this is actually the case, I'm able to tell them exactly what is going on in my head at that moment. So it really is true. So
what's playing in your head right now?
I've got a bit of Harry Potter playing in my head. And Tristan and Prelude and Liebesdote, because I conducted it yesterday. I do crave silence a lot, because there's just so much music going on in my head and I hear so much music all the time, and we're oversaturated with music all the time in the modern world anyway. I mean,
mm-hmm,
I don't last more than 5 minutes in a restaurant that has background music. It's too much.
Mm-hmm.
So yes. You know, one exception to that is when I'm studying in the morning, when I'm meditating or reading the Bible, I think the music might calm down a bit then.
Mm.
But yeah, all musicians need to be away. And also, we quite often will relax as musicians with music that isn't the music we play. So, you know, I don't very often listen to classical music anymore to relax, because I can't help but hear all the imperfections or what I would do differently, or... So you tend to go to other genres to unwind.
Mm. Mm, beautiful. How about you, Tim?
Well, yeah, music, of course, is a temporal art, which it's essentially painted on a canvas of silence, if you will. So the silence is going to be just as important as the sound. And what you don't do or don't play is as important as what you do. That's very, very, very true. And I will often tell the choir, I have this term that I... use, I don't think I've heard too many other people do it, about a loud silence,
yeah,
or a loud rest, where you're going along, going along, going along, and you need the music to completely stop.
Yeah.
Suddenly, and I use the term loud silence, a loud rest. It's sudden and it's big and it's right, very prominent, yes.
Yeah.
But yeah, it's, and like you say, it's something that we are not very comfortable with. I've noticed that with choirs, and not necessarily just the cathedral choir, but any choir I've ever conducted, singers, if there's at least, I don't know if it's true with instrumentals as well, but if you're in a piece and there's a long silence, the tendency is to want to kind of,
exactly,
get going,
yep,
get going, because the silence just sitting in there just can be very, just especially to modern people,
yep,
very uncomfortable. Very, it's like a pause, an awkward pause in a conversation to people sometimes. And now I know, so you know, in society, I see this in church all the time. If there's at least like 15 seconds that people don't have something to do, there's the phone.
So annoying.
You know, it's just immediate. It's like there can be no dead space. There can be no silence.
And silence is such a fertile time for God.
Yeah.
And I think that encounter is hard because people's self comes first.
Yeah.
And they don't like themselves or they haven't thought about their own thoughts.
Yeah.
And so they don't want to face themselves.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But under all of the noise of themselves is also this what the prophet Elijah called the eloquent silence, which translated the still small voice, which is not a good translation.
Yeah.
Eloquent silence is better because within the silence there is this fertile resonance that can create transformation in the person.
Yeah.
But I think, yes, as musicians, I'm sure that you crave it so that you can hear with fresh ears again.
Yep. I'm as guilty as anybody. You know, I struggle that same thing with technology. And so one of the times when I try to get away from everything is like when I'm exercising or riding a bike or something like that. I do not listen to stuff. I just speak into it.
Yeah.
And it's amazing the afterwards you feel all just rejuvenated and you know. Just let your thoughts go where they're gonna in silence and don't let anything.
That is a practice I see a lot of people doing, moving the body, exercising, and relaxing the mind and not doing anything with the sound.
Mm-hmm.
Do you do something like that too?
I sleep with earplugs in and it's got nothing to do with anybody snoring beside me. It's just the luxury of not listening for a few hours because musicians, we hear everything differently. Our ears are far, far more attuned to what's going on around us than everybody else. And there's far more information coming in, and sometimes it just has to stop because it's too much.
Yeah, you know? That's exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Well, I thank you so much for being with me today, and I'm grateful for you.
Well, thank you.
Thank you all for joining me, and God bless you. Have a wonderful day.